Chapter 2. Day's very contemptuous in his behavior towards Frenchmen. He has a natural antipathy to pomp, and swagger, and fierce demeanor. But now that the guardsmen are gone to war, and the dandies of the rag dandies no more are battling like heroes at Balaclava and Inkerman asterisk by the side of their heroic allies, Mr. Punch's laughter has changed to hearty respect and enthusiasm. It is not against courage and honor he wars. But this great moralist, must it be owned, has some popular British prejudices, and these led him in peacetime to laugh at soldiers and Frenchmen. If those hulking footmen who accompanied the carriages to the opening of Parliament the other day would form a plush brigade, wear only gunpowder in their hair, and strike with their great canes on the enemy, Mr. Punch would leave off laughing at Jeems, who meanwhile remains among us, to all outward appearance regardless of satire, and calmly consuming his 5 meals per diem. Against lawyers, beadles, bishops and clergy, and authorities, Mr. Punch is still rather bitter. At the time of the papal aggression he was prodigiously angry, and one of the chief misfortunes which happened to him at that period was that, through the violent opinions which he expressed regarding the Roman Catholic hierarchy, he lost the invaluable services, the graceful pencil, the harmless wit, the charming fancy of Mr. Doyle. Another member of Mr. Punch's cabinet, the biographer of Jeems, the author of the Knob Papers, resigned his functions on account of Mr. Punch's assaults upon the present emperor of the French nation, whose anger Jeems thought it was unpatriotic to arouse. Mr. Punch parted with these contributors. He filled their places with others as good. The boys at the railroad stations cried Punch just as cheerily, and sold just as many numbers, after these events as before. Asterisk, this was written in 1854. There is no blinking the fact that in Mr. Punch's cabinet John Leech is the right-hand man. Fancy a number of Punch without Leech's pictures. What would you give for it? The learned gentlemen who write the work must feel that, without him, it were as well left alone. Look at the rivals whom the popularity of Punch has brought into the field, the direct imitators of Mr. Leech's manner, the artists with a manner of their own, how inferior their pencils are to his in humor, in depicting the public manners, in arresting, amusing the nation. The truth, the strength, the free vigor, the kind humor, the John Bull pluck and spirit of that hand are approached by no competitor. With what dexterity he draws a horse, a woman, a child. He feels them all, so to speak, like a man. What plump young beauties those are with which Mr. Punch's chief contributor supplies the old gentleman's pictorial harem. What famous thews and sinews Mr. Punch's horses have, and how Briggs, on the back of them, scampers across country. You see youth, strength, enjoyment, manliness in those drawings, and in none more so, to our thinking, than in the 100 pictures of children which this artist loves to design. Like a brave, hearty, good-natured Briton, he becomes quite soft and tender with the little creatures, pats gently their little golden heads, and watches with unfailing pleasure their ways, their sports, their jokes, laughter, caresses. Infants terribles come home from Eton, young miss practicing her first flirtation, poor little ragged Polly making dirt pies in the gutter, or staggering under the weight of Jackie, her nurse child, who is as big as herself. All these little ones, patrician and plebeian, meet with kindness from this kind heart, and are watched with curious nicety by this amiable observer. We remember, in one of those ancient Gilray portfolios, a print which used to cause a sort of terror in us youthful spectators, and in which the Prince of Wales, His Royal Highness, was a foxite then, was represented as sitting alone in a magnificent hall after a voluptuous meal, and using a great steel fork in the guise of a toothpick. Fancy the first young gentleman living employing such a weapon in such a way. The most elegant prince of Europe engaged with a two-pronged iron fork the heir of Britannia with a bident. The man of genius who drew that picture saw little of the society which he satirized and amused. Gilray watched public characters as they walked by the shop in St. James Street, or passed through the lobby of the House of Commons. His studio was a garret, or little better, his place of amusement a tavern parlor, where his club held its nightly sittings over their pipes and sanded floor. You could not have society represented by men to whom it was not familiar. When Gavin and I came to England a few years since, one of the wittiest of men, one of the most brilliant and dexterous of draftsmen, he published a book of S. Anglis, and his Anglis were all Frenchmen. I, so keen and so long practiced to observe Parisian life, could not perceive English character. A social painter must be of the world which he depicts, and native to the manners which he portrays. Now, anyone who looks over Mr. Leech's portfolio must see that the social pictures which he gives us are authentic. What comfortable little drawing rooms and dining rooms, what snug libraries we enter, what fine young gentlemanly wags they are, those beautiful little dandies who wake up gouty old grandpapa to ring the bell, who decline ants pudding and custards, saying that they will reserve themselves for an anchovy toast with the claret, who talk together in ballroom doors, where Fred whispers Charlie, pointing to a dear little partner 7 years old, "Why, dear Charlie, as he has very much gone off. You should have seen that girl last season." Look well at everything appertaining to the economy of the famous Mr. Briggs. How snug, quiet, appropriate all the appointments are. What a comfortable, neat, clean, middle-class house Briggs is in the Bayswater suburb of London. We should guess from the sketches of the surrounding scenery what a good stable he has, with a loose box for those celebrated hunters which he rides. How pleasant, clean, and warm his breakfast table looks. What a trim little maid brings in the top boots which horrify Mrs. B. What a snug dressing room he has, complete in all its appointments, and in which he appears trying on the delightful hunting cap which Mrs. Briggs flings into the fire. How cozy all the Briggs party seem in their dining room. Briggs reading a treatise on dog breaking by a lamp. Mama and Granny with their respective needleworks. The children clustering round a great book of prints such as this before us, which, at this season, must make thousands of children happy by as many firesides. The inner life of all these people is represented. Leech draws them as naturally as Teniers depicts Dutch boors, or moorland pigs and stables. It is your house and mine. We are looking at everybody's family circle. Our boys coming from school give themselves such airs. The young scapegraces, our girls, going to parties, are so tricked out by fond mamas. A social history of London in the middle of the 19th century. As such, future students lucky they to have a book so pleasant will regard these pages. Even the mutations of fashion they may follow here, if they be so inclined. Mr. Leech has as fine an eye for tailory and millinery as for horse flesh. How they change those cloaks and bonnets. How we have to pay milliners' bills from year to year. Where are those prodigious chatelains of 1850 which no lady could be without? Where those charming waistcoats, those tunning waistcoats, which our young girls used to wear a few brief seasons back, and which cause Gus, in the sweet little sketch of A Mode, to ask Ellen for her tailor's address. Gus is a young warrior by this time, very likely facing the enemy at Inkerman, and pretty Ellen, and that love of a sister of hers, are married and happy, let us hope, superintending one of those delightful nursery scenes which our artist depicts with such tender humor. Fortunate artist, indeed. You see, he must have been bred at a good public school, that he has ridden many a good horse in his day, paid, no doubt, out of his own purse for the originals of some of those lovely caps and bonnets, and watched paternally the ways, smiles, frolics, and slumbers of his favorite little people. As you look at the drawings, secrets come out of them, private jokes, as it were, imparted to you by the author for your special delectation. How remarkably, for instance, has Mr. Leech observed the hairdressers of the present age? Look at Mr. Tongs, whom that hideous old bald woman, who ties on her bonnet at the glass, informs that he has used the whole bottle of Bomb of California, but her hair comes off yet. You can see the bear's grease, not only on Tom's head, but on his hands, which he is clapping clammily together. Remarkum, who is telling his client here is cholera in the air, and that lucky rogue whom the young lady bids to cut off a long thick piece for somebody, doubtless. All these men are different, and delightfully natural and absurd. Why should hairdressing be an absurd profession? The amateur will remark what an excellent part hands play in Mr. Leach's pieces. His admirable actors use them with perfect naturalness. Look at Betty, putting the urn down, at Cook, laying her hands on the kitchen table, whilst her policeman grumbles at the cold meat. They are cook's and housemaid's hands without mistake, and not without a certain beauty too. The bald old lady, who is tying her bonnet at Tom's, has hands which you see are trembling. Watch the fingers of the two old harridans who are talking scandal. For what long years past they have pointed out holes in their neighbors' dresses and mud on their flounces. Years ago, I've lost my diamond ring. As the dustman utters this pathetic cry and looks at his hand, you burst out laughing. These are among the little points of humor. One could indicate hundreds of such as one turns over the pleasant pages. There is a little snobber gent, whom we all of us know, who wears little tufts on his little chin, outrageous pins and pantaloons, smokes cigars on tobacconists' counters, sucks his cane in the streets, struts about with Mrs. Snob and the baby Mrs. S., an immense woman, whom Snob nevertheless bullies, who is a favorite abomination of Leach, and pursued by that savage humorist into 1,000 of his haunts. There he is, choosing waistcoats at the tailor's such waistcoats. Yonder he is giving a shilling to the sweeper who calls him apting. Now he is offering a pallet to a huge giant who is going out in the rain. They don't know their own pictures, very likely. If they did, they would have a meeting, and 30 or 40 of them would be deputed to thrash Mr. Leach. One feels a pity for the poor little bucks. In a minute or two, when we close this discourse and walk the streets, we shall see a dozen such. Here we shut the desk up, just one word to point out to the unwary specially, to note the backgrounds of landscapes in Leach's drawings, homely drawings of moor and wood, and seashore and London street, the scenes of his little dramas. They are as excellently true to nature as the actors themselves. Our respect for the genius and humor which invented both increases as we look, and look again at the designs. May we have more of them, more pleasant Christmas volumes, over which we and our children can laugh together. Can we have too much of truth, and fun, and beauty, and kindness? End of Project Gutenberg's John Leach's Pictures of Life and Character by William Macapus Thackeray. JLPLC by Gutenberg Edition.